All these slides are on Blackboard. I've put them up this morning, so you don't have to worry too much about what's coming up on here. I'm also recording the actual piece, so I'll put it up as a podcast as well, so hopefully you can focus on what's being said, as opposed to writing all sorts of notes down and various other elements. So, public relations. How do you define it? The relations between the public? Management of reputation? There are a number of ways in which public relations is actually thought about in the 21st century, including actually how has it actually got to us in the first place? Why do we have this thing called public relations? Why is it, in terms of perception, it's often seen as being the dark side of journalism? You're talking about an area of spin. You're talking about areas in which things are being developed and messages are being put out there. We're talking about the narrative. We're talking about how things are developing. If I can kind of cast your mind back a little bit to one or two things, if you just remind me, something I took for Origins of Modern Britain, didn't I? Yes, sir. That's good. Exactly. Yes. Think back a little bit to that and what happened in the 1920s, 1930s America, when primarily there was a concern about using the social sciences to actually inform companies how better to market their goods and skills, etc. So things like psychology, things like sociology, and other areas were being developed within that. But actually, if we're being true to the title of this particular lecture, the origins of public relations, as opposed to the origins of modern Britain, I obviously like origins, like superhero stories, but still, in terms of that origin system, we can actually go back to ancient Greek times, as I'll show you, and before that. Edward Bernays, for that is his name, as opposed to just E. Bernays, Edward Bernays, his definition of public relations was that. And Bernays is generally regarded as one of the founding fathers of what we understand as contemporary modern public relations. And I think there are a couple of key things that come out of that particular question there. It's all about information. It's about persuasion. And it's about making people fit in. Because actually integrating people with people, ensuring people fit in, could arguably be said to be part and parcel of how society actually operates and works, or how companies operate, and so on. Again, there are lots of definitions, but it's worthwhile considering Bernays' line, primarily because, again, he's kind of regarded as one of the key leaders, together with a gentleman called Ivy Lee, of modern-day public relations. But as I said a few moments ago, the thing about PR is you can actually start going all the way back to 2000 BC, pretty much, because human beings have, as a nature of our existence, like to communicate. And actually, you can go back to ancient Iraq in terms of a tablet that was actually talking about more advanced agricultural techniques, passing on information, sharing that information with the public, explaining how farming, agricultural folk could actually make better use of their land. It's all about brand. It's about selling things, really. As we said, what did it actually contain? As you can see there, how do you sow your crops better? How do you irrigate your land? How do you deal with field mice, pesky field mice? How to harvest the whole thing? Now, the win-win situation here is clearly, if you're paying attention to that, and if you're a farmer in ancient Iraq, you might well turn around and say, great, it's fantastic, good news, happy people, good PR. If you're also promoting the sort of way in which the crops are being used and developed to be sold, you know, clearly it's a virtuous circle, because the more successful you are as a farmer, the more product you'll actually have to sell to other people in the countries and indeed in the country throughout. And this is where you get that whole notion of, well, is public relations partly about marketing? Is it about advertising? Is it about telling the truth? That's for open for discussion. In one sense, yes, it is. It was Ivy Lee who actually said his apocryphal statement, ultimately, tell the truth. If you don't tell the truth, the public will find out. sometimes things can be omitted and so on, as we'll see in terms of a number of examples and so on. So there's your initial use of the tablet, the way in which it's being sort of developed, you know, and in many ways, yes, you can draw a direct reference between that and these. Okay? A lot more information on this than the clay tablet, but somehow not quite as warm. If you kind of move slightly further up the scale, you find that in terms of the Roman Empire and areas from that perspective, clearly you got, as the name suggests, an empire. Something in which, you know, people need to be coordinated. And, ooh, huge typo, I just see the typo there. Caesar, not Julius, brief. I shall change that. I shall pull the slides down and put it up immediately. If you're looking at this particular aspect, there you can see a number of key areas in which, if we look back and we do a little bit of investigation in terms of what's happening in ancient Rome and so on, you've got daily papers, you've got commentaries, commentaries of propaganda, you've got Caesar saying how wonderful his occupation happens to be, how things are going, epic achievements. It's all very much in keeping with what we currently regard as public relations spin, propaganda, ways in which things are being sent out to tell people how wonderful this particular person is, this particular product is, and so on and so forth. So, as I say, that whole notion of PR being a relatively recent incarnation, not necessarily. It kind of has a long history in its own way, is comparable and equal to the history of journalism and so on in terms of that comparable media history as well. And because I'm not going to be travelling all the way through the Dark Ages and a variety of other bits and pieces, I want to jump from the period of Rome, sort of the couple of thousand years ago and so on, way up to the 18th century and the start of when we, Britain, collectively, lost the colonies. Embarrassing. I still think they'd be better off with us than without us, but then I really should be armed if I was actually sort of doing that. In terms of this, the whole notion of the Boston Tea Party. Now, it's often said that actually it was a combination of the insanity of King George III and basic arrogance that meant that the American colonists effectively told Britain to go forth and be fruitful and wanted to declare independence. In essence, the line, no taxation without representation, emerged from this particular element from that perspective. But what we do see in terms of the Revolutionary War, which incorporated obviously the 1776 Declaration and so on, is literally everything that was available was used to promote the message of the American independence people. You will see newspapers, pamphlets, pamphleteers, broadsides, sermons, public sessions, town meetings. They're using very much the equivalent to your Twitter, your Facebook, your Snapchat, your Instagrams, and so on. In other words, you're really mass-producing the whole key areas that are coming across from that point of view, and in terms of how we're seeing things being used and developed, etc. And obviously images, pictures worth a thousand words can also get messages across, you know, the battle against the occupying forces, etc., etc. Even the sort of simple messages, sort of slogans that come across. What you've got here is a snake which is comprised of New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, etc., etc. And the line basically being that just as if you actually slice up all of those particular parts of the snake, it won't survive. The line, quite simply, the graphic message there, join or die. You either be part of the United States of America or, effectively, no more. It's interesting, a few years back, California were talking about going independent. I mean, I'm not sure whether they're still sort of developing that. I think there is still a movement, but again, that's an interesting sort of perception to take in terms of how strong, stark images and messages are being used to get points across and so on. A little bit of history there in terms of what we actually see from the whole notion there. It's quite interesting. the importance of symbols, you know, the stars and the stripes, the illustration of how things are developed from that point of view. And again, partly, you know, the thing which said enough is enough, that no taxation without representation, when the government of Britain decided to say, yes, you're going to have to pay some stamp duties on this particular side of things, which effectively meant that every time you actually had any bit of paper produced at all, including even playing cards, you'd have to pay something as well, called stamp duty in terms of that. And so, you know, the location of the meeting where people protested against this, actually in itself, that tree becomes a symbol of, God, another typo, sorry about this, you honestly haven't checked that, public defiance. Sorry, sometimes. Already I would score myself at a 2-1 because I haven't checked the typos, two in a row, it's ridiculous. Again, if we move on a little bit further, move to the end of the 19th century, the mid to the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution is beginning to hit full force and so on. The expansion of the railroad is a huge, massive undertaking. You know, it is literally changing the face of the continent. The Chinese, the African Americans, slave labourers, the Irish, the European migrant workers, etc., who worked and in many cases lost their lives constructing the American Railroad, are an intrinsic part of American history. And actually, one of the messages that needs to come across is, what's it for? What's it worth? Why are we actually doing this and so on? Why can't we just use horses or horse and carts or buggies, etc.? Why do we need this mechanized iron horse? That was the original name of the railway. It was the iron horse to actually travel across America and indeed travel up and down the East Coast, up and down the West Coast and so on. Well, primarily, as you can see there, you're seeing the beginnings of what we would currently refer to as the tourist industry. It's branding for the tourist industry. It's actually getting people to actually say, yes, there is gold in them thar hills. It's time we actually travelled over to actually see the whole thing. We go from East Coast to West Coast. And actually, we can travel by rail. Mass public transport. The whole notion of encouraging the public to develop. These are kind of the drip-by-drip feeds. Yes, on the one hand, it's propaganda. On the other hand, it's actually opening up a range of other elements. And as we can see, you know, you've got this whole notion of excursions with guidebooks saying, you know, if you were tired of life in New York, tired of life on, you know, Boston and so on, why not actually take the train to San Francisco, the Barbary Coast, see what's actually happening on that basis. And obviously, you're going to accentuate the positive. You're going to accentuate the positive in terms of what likely things are going to be there. And actually, this notion, we refer to it as the gold rush, and the reason I say the notion that there was gold in California and so on, the Golden State and so on, that, you know, suddenly people can improve, which actually at its heart is the American dream. The American dream that anybody, any immigrant, no matter what their background, can effectively turn up in this country and become hugely wealthy. It's again a branding side of things. And it's also getting the messages across in terms of how that's working, how you can actually use rail transport, and how it's being developed, built, and so on. There's an example of the time, effectively. You can see in this little poster. It's very simple. You know, what we actually talked about this. You've got everything there. You've got useful reading for those going to California or having friends there. You've got how to test precious metals, so that's always good. If you've ever, anybody seen Paint Your Wagon, the musical? That's an interesting, I mean, that's a, again, that's based on the American Gold Rush and so on. But again, it is this whole system, information about the country and the ancient and modern discoveries of gold. Gold, this fantastic metal. Even the pamphlet, look at the colour. Look at the colour it's printed in. So it's getting that message across there. You know, the sort of the lines, the headlines, it's actually there. So the design, the image, the package, it's classic advertising. You know, way before radio started, way before television started, way before any of the mass media forms of advertising, we're talking about how to promote things. There you have it. And actually, on one level, they're dealing with the land, gold being a precious metal that comes out of the land. Any difference between that and our ancient Babylonian writings of how to actually irrigate your farm more effectively? You know, it's kind of offering things which provide an incentive and some reason for that. Has anybody actually seen the Hugh Jackman movie celebrating this man? Greatest Showman? No? Far too busy working on dissertations, obviously. But it's now available, or will be shortly available on DVD. Michael Crawford was the stage, took part in the stage routine of this. This gentleman, P.T. Barnum, was very much the maestro when it came to publicity stunts. He would develop things, even the title, The Greatest Show on Earth. Everything was actually there. You know, hyperbole, it's way up there. It's basically, this is the best thing you will ever see in any way, shape or form. You will have great jumbo skeleton, huge skeletons is actually there. Whole stack of it scenarios from that point of view. And the quote that I've used in that particular area is well worth considering. Because it's the editor of the newspapers that furnish the wind for P.T. Barnum's sails. They, you know, the whole notion of a puff publicity piece or a soft piece of journalism, writing from the point of view of promoting particular images, can be rooted down in terms of this sort of aspect. And, oh my word, it's the F word. Yeah, actually, one of the ways in the 19th century which Barnum actually operated was sometimes actually make things up. Fake news, fake stunts, and so on. If it gets people talking, if it raises that kind of profile, if it gets them buying tickets to the show, the Great London Circus combined with Greatest Show on Earth, you're going to have a curiosity. You're going to have, you know, a notion, oh, let's go and see it, let's see what's actually there. Now, I'm not saying that Barnum was a fraud, because clearly he wasn't. But he knew how to milk the publicity machine. When it comes to public relations, he certainly knew how to give a very positive side of things. So the very name Barnum becomes associated with publicity and milking that.
Yes. Is this the same Barnum that's been associated with Barnum statements? That is a statement that can pretty much apply to anyone.
Yeah, I mean there is a connection. I mean, he's a showman from that sort of perspective. Mm-hmm. There's another one, contemporary of P.T. Barnum's, Buffalo Bill. Another real person, you know. He existed in the Wild West. The Wild West is a mythology. The notion of the Wild West as we actually saw it portrayed in Hollywood over the 20th century and even arguably in the 21st century in certain instances is as much a mythology as Westworld portrays the tourist trip of androids as robots, robots as westerns, etc. But people like Buffalo Bill, Major John Burke, etc., who promoted that whole side of things, could actually be fated as celebrities. They'd be part of the P.T. Barnum scenario. You'd have this whole notion that, I mean, you know, look at the kind of sensationalist language that's being used. Buffalo Bill's Trail of the Man Tigers, or The Doom of the Branded Hand. And you've got this blurring of the identities between fiction and real life. And clearly, you know, you could say, hang on, isn't that similar to the new Heroes package that Marvel Comics and DC and comics all, you know, where do we blur? You go and see DC Comics on ice, you go and see Marvel on ice, you go and see them at the planetarium. You know, there is this sort of notion of it's promoting a brand. Now, I'm not saying that the general public will say, oh, Buffalo Bill is absolutely real, etc. You know, people ask that, but we like to buy into that mythology. That's part and parcel of how we actually do it. It's the same sort of mythology as believing actually that there's gold over there and that we can exploit those as well from that point of view. Let's move on. There's one which I think you'd probably have huge difficulties with if you actually intended to use that today, although at the end of the 19th century it was actually deemed to be a perfectly valid and legitimate line forward when you're dealing with the Native American. What are they actually doing? They're basically promoting soap. And they're thinking, what a great idea, what a publicity stunt this would actually be. In 1492, Columbus actually discovered America. So it's the 400th anniversary. What can we actually do? I know. We'll recreate a sailing boat, 14-foot sailing boat, to promote this, and we'll get our own brand of soap there, and we'll use this as our main motto, etc., with, if we could teach the Indians to use the polo, it would quickly civilise them. Not really the most, shall we say, sensitive line forward. But again, you find a lot of history of public relations or marketing and branding where messages are, shall we say, looked at from a contemporary perspective, slightly offbeat. It'd be interesting to consider what potentially now, in 100 or so years from now, we'd actually say, what were they thinking? What were they thinking? Anyway, so moving on from that sort of point of view. We finally have arrived, thank God you might well say, at the 20th century. And this is where it starts getting really interesting in terms of public relations and perspective from that. A bit of a timeline that comes across there, including two folk in particular. And I'm not eliminating William Smith, because I think he, again, deserves his recognition for opening the first office, which he specifically entitled a public relations office, again, after sort of working for the Baltimore Sun. And indeed George Michaelis, who in 1900 founded the Publicity Bureau. Because these are people who recognise that there is money to be made from promoting organisations, people, things, activities, events, and so on, to the extent where Ivy Lee, I've already mentioned, together with George Parker, set up Parker and Lee. Fairly short-lived company, only lasted 5 years before Ivy Lee went on and did his own thing. And actually did an awful lot for the Red Cross in promoting the brand of the Red Cross in the First World War. And our first mercenary, actually quoted from the definition of what he maintained is public relations, Bernays, Edward Bernays, set up his public relations office in 1919, again just after the First World War, and again looking at how things could be developed from that point of view. Briefly, if there were two people I'd say take away from this particular session, it would be Ivy Lee and Edward Bernays. Lee, who also went on to actually advise the Rockefeller family and actually humanise the way in which the Rockefeller family were actually seen by getting the Rockefeller family to, or the Rockefeller Jr., to actually talk to his workers, to actually listen to the workers, to actually sort of make sure that you could actually say there are responses being made. In other words, as we say there, Lee's particular belief and conviction was that public relations actually had a responsibility to the public. It's kind of summed up in the title Public Relations. And that responsibility to the public is greater than its responsibility to its client. Hence that line I said earlier, that Lee was often said, you know, above all else, tell the truth. If you don't tell the truth, you're going to be found out. I'm not saying it's a case of George Washington and I cannot tell a lie, I cut down the cherry tree and so on. But fundamentally, that's what it is. And if you are found out and people actually find out that you've been lying to them, then you lose trust. And on another level, public relations is all about trust. It's interesting that Lee himself is generally created with this line, crisis management. How do you actually cope with issues relating to things when they go wrong, when the proverbial hits the fan? How do we connect from that point of view? On a slightly different level, Edward Bernays was very much interested in the social sciences. This is where, again, I come back to what I was talking about in Origins last year. Crime psychology, subconscious, this notion of using science, using objectivities to start manufacturing consent, as Noam Chomsky would actually say. Again, somebody who currently is written very extensively, and I think he's part of the background reading we've suggested for this, that whole notion of engineering or manufacturing consent. Getting to the stage where ultimately we kind of go along with it because, yeah, it kind of makes sense. And this one is particularly interesting. Manipulating public opinion is a necessary part of a fully functioning democracy. Now again, there is a suggestion that actually that's what we're all doing. By the news channels we choose to watch our news on, devices we tend to use, what areas we tend to sort of select for, etc. And ultimately, you know, if we listen to the meteorologist, it might be complete whiteout out there. You know, right, yes, I open that window, look at it, it's a disaster, we're doomed, we're never going to get out of here alive. Or maybe we will. Again, how far do you actually go in terms of how do we sort things through for the benefit of most? Can anybody actually respond to that? Apologies to any vegetarians, it's just I couldn't resist this. There is a vegan equivalent, etc. But that whole concept of having, you know, we talk about the traditional British breakfast, the traditional breakfast and so on. Where did it come about?
I'm not too sure, but I've been told it was invented by some airline to
give to guests. Okay, that's nice response, Gaia. It's actually Edward Bernays. Why did he do it? To sell more bacon. And in a couple of hours from now, I'm actually doing a piece with the British Pork Foundation folk, who are actually talking about how lean pork is much more popular than fat pork. I mean, petite pigs shed pounds as people pork up. British pigs are 44% leaner than their 1970s predecessors, while Brits have, in contrast, porked up. Porky humans have piled on the pounds, increasing in weight by 30% and 18 kilograms since the 50s. So it's a health thing. But going all the way back to Edward Bernays, there is, you know, why effectively he came up with that whole notion of bacon and eggs for breakfast. And probably the airline actually will have actually sort of gone for that one as well. You know, 5,000, you know, how did he actually do this? How did he manipulate it? How did he use the science, the appliance of science, to use that line? Well, he asked 5,000 doctors, what would you actually recommend was right for health? Hearty breakfast. Very good. That's also sort of, again, linked with another survey. You put the two together. Therefore, you know, clearly, if you are a good, upwardly mobile soul, and you can afford it, you say, yes, start off the day with bacon and eggs. It's way forward. Yeah, before that, I'd have nothing for breakfast. Coffee, whatever. Again, it's all in that branding. It's all in the messages, etc. I could go into explaining why Kellogg's actually first came up with the cornflake, but maybe you want to remember that sort of shocking fact? No? How did Kellogg's actually promote cornflakes originally when they put it on the market at the end of the 19th century? It was a device basically it was a nutritional supplement which was supposed to prevent masturbation in young boys. Yeah, try that today. Anyway, still, so again, it's how you sort of change the whole thing through on that. So, given that Edward Bernays started this thing off in 1919 and worked through that, clearly what he also has, what he can also use, is the media, the mass media in particular. And what he would tend to do would be examples such as that. You'd be using the newspapers, you'd tie that in with posters, you'd tie that in with adverts on radio. Remember, of course, we're talking the United States here, because obviously you wouldn't have had adverts in Britain until the 1970s. But you also think about the timing. Timing is everything. As this item hopefully will demonstrate. Assuming all works well.
And so that there's this real openness to Bernays' techniques being used to sell products to the masses.
Beginning in the early 20s, the New York banks funded the creation of chains of department stores across America. They were to be the outlets for the mass-produced goods, and Bernays' job was to produce the new type of customer. Bernays began to create many of the techniques of mass consumer persuasion that he now lived with. He was employed by William Randolph Hearst to promote his new women's magazines, and Bernays glamorized them by placing articles and advertisements that link products made by others of his clients to famous film stars like Clara Bow, who was also his client. Bernays also began the practice of product placement in the movies. And he dressed the stars at the film's premieres with clothes and jewellery from other firms he represented. He employed psychologists to issue reports that said products were good for you, and then pretended they were independent studies. He organised fashion shows in department stores and paid celebrities to repeat the new and essential message. You bought things not just for need, but to express your inner sense of yourself to others.
There's a psychology of dress. Have you ever thought about it? How it can express your character? You all have interesting characters, but some of them are all hidden. I wonder why you all want to dress always the same, with the same hats and the same coats. I'm sure all of you are interesting and have wonderful things about you, but looking at you in the street, you all look so much the same. And that's why I'm talking to you about the psychology of dress. Try and express yourselves better in your dress.
In 1927, an American journalist wrote, "A change has come over our democracy. It is called consumptionism. The American citizen's first importance to his country is now no longer that of citizen, but that of consumer."
He was uniquely knowledgeable about how people in large numbers are going to react to products and ideas and so on.
Lots of really interesting things in that particular aspect. It's worth watching the clip again in your own time. But from the point of view of the celebrity endorsement, the branding that we get, we're just going to the Academy Awards ceremony, admittedly our celebrity aviator there possibly could have done a little more help on her delivery, then no more so than any kind of celebrity athlete and so on that's being used. And it's again that endorsement, that connection with success and the association with success and the expression of the self as an individual, buying the things that effectively make you stand out and make you an individual, all tapped into that. And there's another gentleman who certainly fed into this extremely well, even to the extent that today you see advertisements for Ford cars, Ford Fiestas, Ford, you keep on going, packaging that, the whole sense of scenario, don't experiment, just buy a Ford. You can have any colour as long as it's black, was Henry's classic line. Henry Ford himself had had one or two challenges. I mean, the first couple of companies he's actually got involved with had had major problems. But he settled on this whole notion of the Ford, again, the key to automobile construction, and, again, was also tying this in with sports productions and so on, as we can see here.
999 is a great car because it's an original Henry Ford-built racer, and it's one of the two cars that we have that were built to race during his in-between years when he's trying to find his footing between his first failed attempts at building a car company and then his final success with Ford Motor Company in 1903. 999 was built in 1902, 1 year after Sweepstakes, which is the one that first sort of established his name. His first company, Detroit Automobile Company, had gone belly up, so he started his next company, the Henry Ford Company, after the success with 999, because that generated some more interest. Henry Ford actually did not race in the 999 because he reached a point with that car where it was almost too fast, too powerful for him. He was too scared to race it. So they came up with another fellow, Barney Oldfield, who at the time was a bicycle racer. He'd never driven a car before. But they somehow induced him to take a try at 999, and he was a natural at it. He just got in there, kind of gunned it, drove around the track at high speeds, and did really well, and launched a career for himself. Really became the U.S.'s first big racing hero. 999 is about brute force. That's what I think of when I see that car, because even Sweepstakes has kind of a curved, nice, round body to it. There's no body of any sort on 999. It's just the engine sitting on top of a wood frame with the driver in the back. And there are a couple of interesting things about it. It does not have a steering wheel. It's got a big kind of T-shaped tiller that the driver steers by sliding back and forth. And it's also got no transmission of any kind. What passes for a transmission is just the flywheel, and then it's got a wood block clutch. So you move a lever and it expands those wood clutches against the flywheel, almost like the drums in a brake. It's got a massive engine in terms of displacement. It's just four cylinders, but it's something like 1,154 cubic inches. Barney Oldfield was able to take it up to 60 miles an hour on a track, which is, of course, a mile a minute. And that was kind of the original land speed barrier, if you will. You know, people thought of it like the sound barrier at that time. But no one would ever get that fast. No one could ever break that speed.
Amazing. 60 miles an hour. But again, still branding that whole notion of relating sports, relating racing to a successful product and a car product is actually out there. And any of those sort of decisions with respect to the Formula One package that goes on today in sport and the relationship between brands and cars still echo those particular aspects as well. So, in essence, we've got to the situation where public relations is being used extensively. I would venture to suggest that everybody in this room, whether it's the clothes you've bought, whether it's the slogans and the icons and the images and the logos you're actually using, we're all guilty of being suckered in, possibly, or making decisions partly on the back of advertising, marketing, and indeed PR. Because obviously if a company has negative PR, you can have a whole range of other challenges with respect to that. But sometimes you want to actually push the branding a wee bit more. You want to actually ensure that sex, drugs, and rock and roll is actually seen as an exciting, dynamic scenario. You know, normally you would say, oh, it's a photograph of a man's crotch, or possibly a female crotch, with the zip very much to the fore, which indeed you either zip up or zip down, etc. That was 1981. And as you can see from Egan's perspective on John Pasha's design, what you actually get there is everything that the Rolling Stones want to be seen as. Rebellious. Basically, dynamic. I mean, interesting enough, they're going on another tour this year. The Zimmer frames out, etc. But they're still, you know, branding this whole system. And again, in terms of logo, you've got this. You've also got that in terms of the whole notion of the Jagger-esque strut, the attitude, the lips, the whole package that come through with that. So again, as a brand, it's working, it's functioning, same way as the Beatles and Apple and various other areas. It makes us connect those elements. You also get consistent lines here. I mean, these are two wonderful examples of the 1970s and the early 1980s and the onset of Mrs. Thatcher in power, etc. This was the poster that Saatchi & Saatchi effectively came up with. And Saatchi & Saatchi are very clear. They were public relations. They are a public relations agency. They still work on that basis. And it's the very clear, unambiguous message that the Labour government at the time, under James Callaghan, was not functioning. And you literally just have those massive three words there, another two smaller words there, unemployment office, huge long queue, and then the final strapline there. It's interesting, actually, sometimes had the student union post, you see so much with blah 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 blah, and you just think, actually, you just need to simplify your campaign, effectively keep it down to the absolute bare essentials so it becomes memorable. Keep it simple, stupid. It's the KISS mantra, and actually you need to focus on that. Same with headlines and various other things. Of course, here we have the perfect image of a caring, domesticised Iron Lady at home doing the washing up and so on and so forth. Slightly more upbeat, up tempo, upbeat more ways than one. What a cool guy Tony Blair is. You know, he can't be whispering in Pudsey's ear, let's go and have a war to find some weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Oh, no, of course not. But you're branding in the 90s this whole notion of Britain being cool. The notion of cool Britannia. Again, it's not that we're focusing on the image, the branding from that perspective, it's something that's seen as, again, six words. New Labour, New Britain, New Vision. Result, new Parliament, new government. Very effective, very simple, and working on, again, the rule of three. Repetition, repetition, repetition. Education, education, education. And the sort of interesting design structure of the Labour and the Rose from that sort of point of view. Again, contrast that with the one that we've actually just seen. Fundamentally, not a huge deal of difference. That's slightly starker, slightly brighter. That's looking more of an optimistic sort of moment. Does any of this, and this is a criticism in terms of public relations, does any of this actually talk about the things that matter in terms of their manifesto? No. Does it actually talk about any of the substance of the parties? No. Is it style over substance? Absolutely. Is there anything wrong with that? That's for you to decide. Or is it a case of you scratch the surface and you simply get more surface. And that is one of the, again, the major criticisms in terms of how public relations has developed and evolved, etc. So we've talked about how from Barnum, through Bernays, through Lee and somebody, this whole notion of using traditional media has been a consistent part of the whole package. And use being quite deliberate in that sort of aspect. Newspapers have been, for the last 150 years, and possibly for the next 40 or 50 years, what we would define as that workhorse of the public information system. It's where jobbing journalists will effectively produce stuff and promote stuff and follow stories through and so on and so forth. And that will come through a variety of filters. This, of course, is one of the challenges with respect to social media, insofar as it's often touted as being an unfiltered news source, as opposed to having syndicates and agencies that technically should check sources and work through that basis. The notion of magazines, a bit like common websites, which you could say leads to echo chamber effects and various other elements, that actually people who read certain magazines, New Scientist, Scientific American, for instance, presumably have some sort of interest in science. If you read The Economist, Financial Times, presumably you have some interest in finance. If you read 442, Tennis World, Rugby Today, and so on, presumably you're more interested in sport, etc. So in other words, selecting the right magazine to reach your audience, and bearing in mind a line that comes across from radio, that's often been said that in commercial radio, the idea is not to deal with content programming, but it's to deliver audiences to advertisers. Again, something I'll talk about in the next few weeks or so from that point of view. But clearly you're looking at those particular aspects. I've said radio there is arguably, wonderful word, the most flexible communication medium. It's because it's portable. It's because even in a day where we think we don't settle down and listen to the radio, we can listen to our radio through our mobile devices, we have all sorts of apps and so on, we can through podcasting, portable on-demand listening, listen to it at any particular time, and we don't necessarily have to give it its full attention. Whereas in most cases, even with YouTube, you kind of have to watch the actual screen, etc. But where television, in essence, scores probably more highly than radio, is it actually starts talking about this whole notion of the cult of celebrity. If you look at a lot of the family favourites, the nation's treasures over the last 30 or 40 years, the Bruce Forsyths, the Les Dawsons, the Morkman Wisers, and so on, no, normally you'd say interesting characters, but it was the fact that they appeared regularly on television, the fact that week in, week out, these would be familiar faces that would be appearing in people's living rooms, that almost led to a kind of familiarity. It's one of the suggestions that's been put forward in terms of why Trump actually secured success in the States, because he'd already had a fantastic series called The Apprentice. You know, that was his baby before Alan Sugar actually used it. And that whole notion of regularly seeing Trump as the person who said, you're fired, etc. Yes, he knows how to sort it out. He's sorted this person, he can sort the country out as well. So on some level, you're dealing with that whole notion of how people are seen, how people are being packaged in, etc. And of course, as you can see in that sort of system, clearly there are shifts, you know, from being a staunchly Tory-supporting, Margaret Thatcher-supporting, John Major-supporting paper. There was this switch, as they say themselves, the branding is a historic announcement for Britain's number one newspaper. Give change a chance. And of course, the whole notion of film. Why is it people care about the hashtag MeToo? Why is it people have concern? Why is it Weinstein's company has basically gone into liquidation and so on? Because actually, on some level, we're pursuing the cult of dreams. The reason movies, whether you consume them through Netflix or Amazon Prime, through TVs, through the traditional cinematic form, is they're telling stories. Probably the same story, they're really only six or seven basic plot lines, but they're still getting that message out there. And we are familiar, even if we've never seen a Tom Cruise movie, or a Leonardo DiCaprio movie, or a, it may insert Hollywood star here, movie, you still get a sort of sense of where they're coming from. A line from that. So film still pretty powerful and potent as a way in which media messages are put together. And of course, moving right up to date here, yes, we are on time, it's good, to the whole notion of how we see social and digital media impacting on public relations.
I'm Ted Rubin, and I just wanted to say a quick hello to the summer class at Penn State studying persuasion.
Sorry, I'm always trying to say, hello, Ted. Sorry.
PR and the masses. And I want to make really...
I don't think so. Well. Now,
one very important point to start. For me, it's not about persuasion. It's about adding value. I like to say that we're going from a time when it was convince and convert to converse and convert, which means that we have to start thinking in a whole different way. Consumers are sharing. They're talking to each other. It used to be that somebody called customer service. They were initially always given a no because 70% of the people hang up the phone, and all that the brand could see was the people they got off the phone. Now they move people much more quickly through the queue. But now we have to think about and realize that when people get off that phone call and they're told no, that they're doing something. Before they did it, we just weren't as aware. They were still doing it, just wasn't spreading as quickly. Now they've got social platforms that allow them to share that rigorously. And you have to think about that. So I want you guys, while you're working on this course this summer, to start thinking about PR in a whole different way. Normal PR and the problem I have with PR agencies and social, not PR agencies in general. I think when they do what they do best, they do a great job. But when they try to do social media, their culture and their DNA does not allow them to do it. Their culture is, their DNA and their culture is about less is more, controlling the message. And to me, social is the complete opposite. I don't want to control the message. I want to see where it's going to go. And I want to give more information, not less, so I can see what people are going to do with it. So start thinking about engaging, interacting, and how does a brand, when you think of yourself either as a personal brand or representing a brand, how do we add value and get people to engage and share with us? Remember something, and this is something that kills me all the time. You guys have heard about the changes in the algorithms of Facebook and the brands that are complaining. I look at them and they say, you know, hey, you've had free rent for 4 years and now all of a sudden you've got to pay. Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal. The other side, and the reason I love the changes is because the people that are willing to work hard, experiment, test, and see what works and evolve their strategy daily are the ones that are succeeding. I'm getting more value out of Facebook than I ever got. So think about it this way. You guys are young, you're probably not working at major brands yet, but maybe you have interned or talk to people at brands and ask them, how often did they go to the pages of the people who are their fans on Facebook, who like their pages, or the followers on Twitter? I guarantee you, almost no one is going to raise their hand. They're going to look at you quizzically. Well, you guys have probably all heard the expression, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in that meeting or during that discussion. Well, consumers today are inviting you into their living rooms and nobody's going. I'm going to leave you with two challenges. Number one, I want you to start visiting the pages of the people that follow you on Facebook and the people that follow you on Twitter. I want you to see what conversation they're having. Or better yet, go pick a brand. Everybody in the class, pick a brand. Or maybe one or two, or maybe three, and start seeing what their fans are talking about, what their followers are talking about, and then report back about it and see if you can come up with an idea of how better to engage them or things that they're interested in. And the second challenge I want to give you has to do with the way you communicate. So everybody knows what this is, I'm sure, right? It's an iPhone. Now, when I speak in front of audiences and I ask people, what is this? And I ask them, what's the biggest word in the iPhone? Invariably, everybody in the audience shouts out, I. But the biggest word is phone, okay? It's not just about you. So here's something I want you to do. Everybody has a smartphone, right? Well, they all come with apps. I'm sure all you guys have apps on your phones. But there's an app that comes on this, automatically installed, that most of you probably don't even know exists. It's got a keypad, and if you press 7010 numbers, you can actually hear somebody's voice. It's remarkable. You don't have to use emoticons to express emotion. So I'm gonna give you guys a challenge. I know you don't like using it or hearing people's voices. But I want you to pick up the phone every day for the next 30 days and call somebody you haven't spoken to in a while and just say hello. Ask them, what can I do for you today? Or how can I help you? Just make it easy, make a quick phone call, and do it one day, every day this month, and see how it changes your relationship with those people.
Whoa, radical stuff, using an iPhone as a phone. And yet, what's he actually arguing on that basis? It's saying that, yes, we can have a world. In fact, I had a situation where one of my PR students actually said they'd followed somebody a student on the course who literally was watching an episode of Friends on their iPhone, and they walked across the bridge, and I just thought, what unbelievable. Yes, you can actually use it to minimalise your piece. Perhaps the person didn't actually realise you could actually watch it at any particular time. You'd never, maybe she just watches all the television while she's, you know, walking around the whole system. But it's how you're using these tools, how you're actually getting messages out from that perspective, which is very much at the heart of this whole aspect. So, as we begin to sort of come to a conclusion for the packages today, I just want to sort of raise a few of these key issues in terms of, as with all sort of essays and thoughts, where are the sort of things that can still be explored? What other areas can we develop? Well, things to take away from today, hopefully. Number one, this is not new, okay? This is using slightly new technology, but the actual content and the sort of area of getting messages out there to mass audiences and actually promoting goods, products, people, military campaigns, propagandizing, politics and so on, it's pretty much been with us since, you know, the first Cro-Magnon folk were sort of developing their sort of tools in Africa and so on. There isn't anybody on the planet, no matter what their race, colour, particular sort of state of existence happened to be, that isn't engaged in it at some way or in some way all the time. You know, we're listening, we're hearing, we're engaging, we're working through that process. I've mentioned the P word a couple of times, but spoilers, I've got the, you get another session next week, so I don't want to go too far down that line, so we'll just hold fire on that. But also bear in mind the way in which you get the whole notion of politicisation of public relations, that notion of Bernays and Lee and the whole notion, and then latterly sort of writers such as Noam Chomsky and so on, who will effectively characterise the media forms in ways that really make use of all the media. So it's not just print, it's not just radio, it's not just film, it's not just multimedia and so on. Again, looking through that. And again, the key aspects that we've actually got there is the notion of having some desired influence. It's often said that one of the key things about public relations is that it's designed to influence people. Nudge theory is something which comes out of that. That actually somehow you want to, I mean, very good example in terms of public health England at present is the whole aspect relating to sugar and the obesity crisis and the kind of, you know, choose 100 calorie snacks, 2 a day max. I'm even saying the slogan, the kind of areas that come across in that in terms of ways in which challenges are seen as being part and parcel of the whole system. You look through the health service in particular, there are slogans and brands such as coughs and sneezes spread diseases. It was a very popular phrase that was sort of emerged in the sort of 50s and 60s. And again, you know, the purpose of that is you've got a handkerchief, sneeze or blow into that. You just sort of cough your guts over something. It's, you know, it's, there are sort of areas there in which you will actually be using all media forms to get people to either change their habits, their concerns. Smoking is a good example of something which has gone and gone full circle. Smoking was originally being touted very much as a health option. You want to calm your nerves? Have a cigarette. You know, it's a really good way of actually, you know, not just being cool, but you'd have a cigarette. Lots of doctors are sort of shown on health adverts of the 1930s, 40s and 50s, etc., you know, recommending, you know, I'd recommend this particular thing to patients and so on. And then if you add on to that the reinforcement of Hollywood, how it kind of promotes smoking, etc., look at any Hollywood movies pre-1980s, you know, cigarette smoking, very much a key part of that whole system. Now, any smokers in here? Yay! Oh, I thought it was going to be 100% there. So, out you go, pariah! It's a different situation. Are you trying to give up? Or are you?
Yeah, I suppose.
So you're heading towards the lot. But again, it's changing that behaviour. It's working through that process.